Now, the book of Daniel, as you know, is to be considered in these three meetings. We start with chapter 1, as you'll expect, the first chapter of the book of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldees. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Ananiah, Mishael, Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defy himself with the portion of the king's meat, or with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defy himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink, for why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? And then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzer, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenances of the children not eat off the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest dealing with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzer took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them first. As for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king has said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. That will do for our reading. One thing that human beings have nothing whatever to do with, and that is deciding what period in the world they should be allowed to dwell on earth. And I'm sure if any of us had been selecting a time to live in the world and a place to live, the last place we would think of living and the last time we would want to have lived in it was the days of Daniel as a prince in Jerusalem. He had we would almost say, humanly speaking, the misfortune to arrive in the world at a very sad time for his people. That had nothing to do with him. We've always to remember there's much in our lives that we just don't control. and be satisfied that he's got that way. God has settled that, and let him settle it, and that's his affair. What we'll have to do, of course, is to learn to make the best of where God puts us. And that's exactly what we will try and find out from this precious book of Daniel. Now, Daniel is one man whose life spans a long period. He, as you know, was a lad possibly in his teens when the Babylonian Empire was established. And he lived throughout its existence. And right over into the next empire, the Persian Empire, he would write, as we just read at the end of chapter 1, until the days of Cyrus. That means to say that the whole 70 years of Israel's servitude to the king of Babylon, Daniel lived through it all. And that, I think, is marvelous. What we should learn from that is this, that in spite of all the dangers that he was in, and all the apparent disasters that were about to fall on him, he was still spared through the ball and was preserved right to see not only the start of the kingdom and its continuance, but right to the very end of Babylonish power and glory. Now he differs from all the other prophets in this respect, like others up to here, up until here. But all the prophets that God had raised up in Israel, there were always men that spoke to Israel and warned them of their evils and of the ways to live. Whereas Daniel's ministry was almost entirely either a narrative of himself and his doings, but particularly his messages to foreign kings. To put it in our modern language, he was a missionary prophet. That is, his message was for foreigners. And he's the great sample of a man who God raised up to make known his name among the heathen. That is a most important side to remember, that God has an interest in mankind, wicked men as well as good men. Here's a man, Nebuchadnezzar, a wicked, cruel, ruthless man. And here's a big empire of wicked rulers of one form or another. And yet God is making his name known there. And he's sending a missionary there, and he's going to make known his name in that part. And that's most important. Be a child of God, don't forget, you have a big business in that. And your big business in this world is making God known, for he's not known. Meeting with people that don't deserve, we might say, to know anything that's worth knowing. They're so wicked and sinful and vain. And yet God, in his wonderful way, means that those people should have a knowledge of himself and gain that knowledge through our missionary efforts. Which is somebody, I hadn't even thought of going to the mission field. No way, you needn't cross the ocean or the further lands explore. You can find the heathen nearer. You can meet them at your door. You see, we don't need to go too far to meet with heathen. I often think that one of the ways that God has of reaching mankind is to send his children into circles where God is not wanted or appreciated, and in those circles, they're allowed to make known his name. Then again, I think you will agree that Daniel was greatly influenced by those who went before him. Possibly, we have no idea, but possibly one of the men that specially helped young Daniel was the man Jeremiah. Well, you know, Jeremiah was in close contact with the palace where this prince was reared. And therefore he had a great opportunity. Daniel had a great opportunity of benefiting by the presence of that older man, the prophet Jeremiah. Always remember that not only do men's words stay with us, but men that God hath raised up have an influence upon us. Their very character, their trials, their messages from God, they leave impressions, and their whole demeanor leaves impressions upon the mind. Jeremiah was, as you know, alive at the very time when Israel was carried into captivity. And so when this boy, that we speak on in a moment or two, was carried away
The prophet Jeremiah was right in the thick of the whole experience. Therefore, he was indebted to that former prophet. Dear brother, whatever else you do, get rid of the spirit of independence. Now, please, dear, it's distressing to see how many, and they gather a wee smothering of knowledge, and they scrape it up, and they think, well, we have it all, and nobody's any use in it. We can carry on without the rest. Now, that sort of spirit is not helpful. God has so arranged it that we all need each other, and we need to benefit from one another. And all of us that are a while on the way, we owe a debt that we can never repay to those older men that are now in glory whose voices we will never hear again. Now keep that in mind. So please, try your best to get rid of that spirit of independence, either as a company or as an individual. This idea of isolationism that many have seemingly adopted and sit away up on a pedestal in cold isolation, it is neither good for them nor beneficial to those they influence as they meet with them from time to time. The prophecy of Daniel, as you know, divides into two major parts, very clearly stated. The first part is six chapters, it's equally parts, it's not often we get the chapters equal, but it's equal. And six chapters are what we might call those experiences that Daniel had, and those historical bits, those are the bits that people want to understand. But then you see, I began to think of, possibly there are young believers coming to these meetings, and you bear with them, you older folk that know it all, you just bear with them, because they don't know it all, and they might benefit from the early chapters just as much as we would try to benefit from the latter chapters. Now, it's not only divided in two parts, but the strangest thing, I suppose, about it is that it's written in two different languages. Now, don't be thinking of your authorized version when I say that. But it's like the Book of Ezra, in this respect, not only is part of it written in Hebrew, but part of it is written in Aramaic or Syrian or Chaldean, whatever word you like to use, to describe the other language that was used in Babylon. Now, that's a strange thing, isn't it? That a man's writing a book, and he comes to a certain spot, and he just changes the language, and he starts writing another language. And then after he's written a while in another language, he goes back to his own language again. If you got a letter like that, you know, you'd be all amazed about it, wouldn't you? You'd be surprised about it. Why did he change his language? Why did he use the heathen languages, we might say, and he got the religious one of his own dollars? Now, I think you will find, if you examine the part that's written, it starts in verse 4 of chapter 2, and it goes right on to the end of chapter 7. If you look at those chapters, you'll find that they have mainly to do with the heathen side of things. And I'll put it just simply like this. When he's writing to heathens and about heathens, he uses heathen language, if you'll allow that. Now, when I say that, I don't want you to do away with inspiration. That's not the point. I'll mention this in a minute. But then when he's dealing with the recovery of God's people, he goes back to their own language. Now, I think maybe that would be a lesson for us all, wouldn't it? That when we're speaking the gospel, we preach it in its own language, as it were. We preach it to sinners that sinners can understand us. And when we're preaching to Christians, we preach to Christians that can understand us. We change our language, in a sense, though we're supposed to always speak it in English as best we can. We weren't quite clear on that. Now, I suppose you younger Christians wouldn't also know that the New Testament is not written in Hebrew. It's written in Greek. Because, you see, New Testament language has to do with the world at large. And therefore the world's language is used in its original writings. That means to say that in our Bibles, I hope you young folk are clear on this, you have three languages introduced. You have the Hebrew language that Abraham and his posterity have carried right through. That's one of the things that Abraham brought into existence, we might say, the Hebrew language. Then you have the Chaldean language that we have intermixed both in Ezra and in this book, and a verse, I think, in the prophecy of Jeremiah.
And then we have the New Testament written in Greek. And there's a reason for all that.
God has worked.
Did you ever notice
that when God was speaking to Paul in the Damascus Road, he used the Hebrew language? He spoke to him in the Hebrew tongue. That must have impressed Paul greatly.
To know that God would speak in, we might say, the very language of his father, and speak to him in the Hebrew tongue.
Now don't ask me what language we use up in heaven, but we're all going to be able to understand each other and sing together as we were here yesterday.
Well, what language that will be? We do not know. Well, at least there's one thing sure. There will be a language in heaven that all of us can share it.
Now, that's the second point or so that we brought out in the book of Daniel.
The next thing that we want to say is this, that the book opens with the first captivity of the children of Israel that were carried down to God. Now, for the sake of the young again, it's quite likely, I think correctly, that there were three occasions when Nebuchadnezzar took prisoners to Babylon. That covers a period of perhaps the most of 15 to 18 years, somewhere in there. So that we mustn't imagine that there just was one invasion of Palestine, and that the whole nation was carried away, and that they were landed in Babylon. And that was the whole thing. Now that's not correct. When Nebuchadnezzar came the first time, he evidently chose the choicest in the land, the princes that Daniel was amongst. He came up again, and he took the great mass of the people. There was a complete riddance, as it were, of the population that was worthwhile. He left a few of the poor. And then, possibly with a very short space between, he came and he burnt the house, and he burnt the city, and he destroyed and broke down the wall. I hope you're all clear on that. That simply means, now will you please remember that there are three thoughts you keep clear in your mind now when you're studying your Bible. One is this, you keep the thought of the captivity. I should say the servitude in mind. They shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then you keep in mind the captivity. And then you keep in mind the desolations. You just tell it. Remember those three words. The servitude, the captivity, and the desolation.
I thought that was all the same thing.
No, it's not. They didn't begin at the same time, nor they didn't end at the same time.
Oh, you're all frightened now, are you?
The servitude began when Nebuchadnezzar took the first prisoner, and the nation came under the dominion of Nebuchadnezzar, even though most of it wasn't carried away, but they were under the servitude that started. And that's the 70-year servitude which ends with the decree of Cyrus in the first chapter of the book of Ezra. You hear that? That's the servitude. The captivity began at the time when the nation was carried away. And that again lasted for 70 years. But didn't end as quick as the servitude. And then the desolation. You see, when did they begin? Well, they began when the city was burnt. The place was left desolate. I think common English would tell you that. You see, when did they end? They ended when the temple was built. Now, would you notice that in the building of the temple, they were held up for perhaps maybe 18 years or so, or for a number of years anyhow. I'm not going to try and keep numbers in the head for my name wouldn't fool them. And you know why we were held up? Because you see, the 70 years desolation had ended. And until they were ended, and in a matter of months, the house was built. When God's clock comes to the right thing, he can get things done just in his own way. Will you please keep that in mind?
Oh, I think it's marvelous. I think that God's working in your program.
Now, you men all know this. The first man to get a program was Abraham. And he got an outline of the time that Israel would spend in Egypt. And that there would be 400 years. That is from the
with Elijah to the coming up out of Egypt for 400 years.
But you feel nothing. You're not of a deal.
Let me not to have everything. God gave the program. This is what I want you to notice. And if Israel had wept and prayed and cried and sighed and grew, they couldn't shorten the thing.
God's program was protected.
And then God said to Abraham, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet through. So another 38 years had to be spent in the wilderness before that cup was through.
And God would allow them to go over and destroy those nations.
I want you younger Christians to get to see that your God, and my God, and the God of the Bible, is a God who can foretell the future and do it with precision and accuracy that would amaze you. And what seems to be controlled by man is altogether over ruled by a major hand far beyond what we can understand.
Now, I want to take our minds just quietly. Look, you're alive. And there are a number of lads. They are probably in their early teens, maybe 14 to 16. He's brought up in a palace. He's a prince. He's a royal star. He's been well attended to. He has been what many in the nation knew nothing about. He's been educated. Because that was a favor granted to the princes and important folk in the land. Now he's going to be carried away from that circumstance. Maybe not just this day and many other days. But he's in the city of Jerusalem and he's round about there. And now he's lifted out of that. He's landed away there. He's got him mutilated. And he's put there and into captivity. Into
that was a big
fact. Some of you young lads heard of your nice home and your mother's attendance and your care and your kindness.
Down with you somewhere
in the heart of Africa among savages, away into the dark corners of Russia. You have found yourself a very different boy. No longer earnest to lean upon. No mother to go to. No one to advise. There they are.
They've landed in a new land. Where everybody speaks a new language. Where the whole outlook is so different.
And everything's trying and testing. And everything is so oppressive that it's hard for us to feel as those lads must have felt. Powerless in the hands of an enemy. And that would put anyone to the test. Especially very young. Now you will notice more, and very quickly notice, that as soon as you start to read this first chapter, the emphasis is always on the Babylonian throne.
Bring it to thee, bring the vessels out of the sanctuary of God and bring them to the house of his God.
You see, we want to keep in mind this week if we can never think of it at all, and that is when we're dropping up our dribble and bubbling and all that kind of thing, we're looking at the world religiously. The whole scene around Nebuchadnezzar was steeped in religion. The godless religion. Don't let us forget that. Wicked, godless religion, but nonetheless religious. Babylon is always an illustration, a picture of the religious world. But you know, the world has to have a religion. And the world is still being anxious about religion. And the features of it are portrayed here for us in this opening chapter of Daniel. Then again, you will notice that when these young boys arrived down there, the big thought in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar was this: these are good material for our religious performance.
We want the best.
Well, the religious world
has never been satisfied
with anything but the best that yet you can produce.
We see in those boys the potential that is needed. And we're going to do two things with them.
We're going to educate them in our language. We're going to rule them out. We're going to teach them the doctrines, the ideas of the Chaldeans. We're going to put into them a cult, an idea of things that they know nothing about, but they have the ability to absorb it.
That's important. We would not really think at all of this thing we're thinking about with a lot of boys. A lot of boys that could speak his own language. Not at all. He's not educating them in the sense of just merely teaching them a language. But he wants to get them conformed to his way of thinking. And to promulgate them to, we might say, adorn his religious performances. He wants them along that line. And that's why he's so particular as to who he selects. They were, I was going to use some other language for the top of the city. They were all people from the past of their next class. They were IQ. Their IQ were all that.
Maybe it would interest some of the boys here if they would, at some time, maybe not now, but later on in life, if you can get a concordance of these with the rest of the languages. If you notice that in this book of Daniel, you perhaps have the word know, and wisdom, and knowledge, and ability, and understanding. You have that word more often in Daniel than any other book in the Bible, possibly. Maybe about 100 times. And about half of every word, every word you can think of, as it were, is penned in to give us the idea we want in a man. Ability we want knowledgeable men, we want wise men, we want shrewd men, we want capable men. That's what we're after. Now just take a glance at your Bible, I'm not asking you to read too much, but just take a glance at one of the verses and see. Look at verse 4. Children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, not as they wanted, good looks, good personalities, skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Not only the tongue, but the learning as well. Note that. Now do you see the pairing of a word? One on the top of the other. What is there? Yes, the emphasis was on the fact. These boys are to have major ability. They're to be the ordinary fellows. They're to be the right men and the right stuff at that. Now, just another glance to emphasize that. And look at verse 20. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and so on. So that you see you have wisdom and understanding and so on. That is, he wasn't men of capabilities. That's the great cry, you know, in the world today, isn't it? He wanted men and he could look out for that. That's why you see that in this world, if they're going to have a big campaign that puts them on photograph on the very nice of. What if he's just an ordinary 5'8", wouldn't he? He wouldn't put him on a choice. He wouldn't spoil the picture. So you want to have more of it? And the man with a nice smile, a nice countenance, you see. It's all this stuff, isn't it? James is always a lovely looking man, isn't he? You could sit and go down for hours. Now you could. What he says now is nothing, but he's a lovely face. Well, that's what evidently Nebuchadnezzar wanted nice boys to look at. Then isn't he a knowledgeable man? Oh, what do you mean? What he knows. Look at what he knows. He's the greatest scholar in the country. Listen to his learning. Isn't that still being emphasized? Yes, you hardly get a man's meetings announced in the religious world so many letters after his name. What that was it? As if the preaching was going to mean anything, the letters were going to mean anything to his preaching. But you see, that's to impress the people. Now, this man's ruined himself. This man has got the, he has got the grave. He has got the grave matter. He's the boy. No. That's the worst. Wouldn't the man know it? Whether he knows God or not, he knows a different matter. Whether he's a fellowship with the Almighty or not, a different matter. But only he has knowledge. That's the reason that we want to impress the importance of knowledge. Dr. Nipping, young man, is a very solid guy, isn't it? Putting ideas into young men. Oh, I think that to me is very sad. The poison of man's thinking. To rule a man with ideas in his mind, that will be his ruination in time. And if he continues that way, he will ruin for eternity. I judge that that is something that should make us sure. You are a young man. And if they left, if they have not a knowledge of God, of the end of the world, they have reached the things, they will have been ruined for the rest of their life. And that I judge to be moved in for. And the next thing is this. Now, in order to keep up their good appearance and their healthy look, and possibly to develop their physique, the king decided that he would select a special diet for them. And he said they were to receive their portion from the king's meat. That is to say, the boys, the captives, were going to eat the king's meat. And that was what he said. By the king's meat. And you couldn't have better. Couldn't have better. I know that most of the prison fare is not too good. And people carried into captivity are usually fed on the meanest. Oh, I often think of those prisoners that were the star of the man there during it. But I don't know if I was in a house. But it was from Austria, Hungary, when he captured during the Second World War. And he told me that every 4 weeks they went in through a doctor, and a lady doctor, and she pinched the back of her neck, and there was any flesh between the skin. And the last test of what comes from the two skins rub close together. And when they rub close together, then she said, that was that's enough. You were done. You never recovered the heart of your life usually. But we have a result of that. Some of them started to eat too quickly and went out through it. Cutting timber in an old pit of the cell, up and down the cell, where the poor men were reading and reading. And that's when I wrote in Haynes and Horatius. And I was out about the air stretch of Vancouver, and some of the listeners might have been for that much house of it still away. We'll have that better experience. But that's not how these chapters are going to be treated. No, no. They're going to get the best that the king can provide. Why? Because he wants to see it reducing your needs. Nice appearance, and keeping up his good looks, and he wants them to be fat and flourishing on his side. You know how the boys are made. I was just some of the boys, those little fellows, in those days, they were trying to tell you, it's not a bit of a far rebellion. Later on, we read that he made them with sanctuary, so that he was neither a vegetarian, nor was he a teetotaler, as we might put it in the stronger sense. No, no, not in the point at all. Why did they refuse the food? Many years of time when you can eat in the bed. And if you do very well, you've got a voice down in their teens at the table, mind you, they can clean up a bit. And a wee bit of meat would go well at that age, wouldn't it? The old fella, really, you know, he wouldn't mind. Maybe his food not too good, but he wouldn't very well get a stick in front of him right now. But the young man doesn't know, he would like it. Why did they not take it? They knew. In their conscience, they understood that that had been offered to idols. That was defiling meat. And by eating the king's meat, they were having fellowship with his idolatry. And with a good conscience, they couldn't say it. And that's a tough thing, isn't it? nobody there to take notes from them, and there was nobody taking their photograph and saying, I saw him doing it. And there was nobody clipping a wee bit out of the newspaper and saying, did you see where so-and-so was doing this or doing that? There was nobody watching them at all. Not a one thing. And there wasn't going to let the palace when I said a word to them, only just that good. Why, you're getting a nice thing today. You'd have been very happy with them. There was no one to get back to them. There was no one to run away home and say, did you see this grateful thing? Hebrews 7:18. I got it was true. You would wonder they hadn't a conscience about it. No, nobody knew anything about it. I mean, nobody would care. This was going to put the man in charge of them, I was going to say the principal of the college, so that's really what they amounts to, for this is the Royal College. I suppose you always noticed that they like to get the word Royal beside the college, even the Royal College of Mercy, did you ever notice that? And the Royal College is this, and the Royal College is that, and the Royal College is something else. Yes, you're the army for the college. Oh, they have all that. Well, this is the Royal College, you say. This is the King's College. Like they are at the front, you know, the Royal College. Yes, this principal of the Royal College, he begins to worry about himself. He says, you know, you boys are not as nice looking and as favorable looking and as well nourished as the other boys. I'll get into trouble because I shouldn't have let you off with this. Well, my old Daniel doesn't put it too strong for me, just as you just asked.
We have a preliminary question. And this. I didn't know maybe that we would have had to
do it. But in 10 days, just you have a look at us, see how they did. Not the 10 days on the vegetables. On the most of the stay solid, or whatever you like to put, like these fruit things and trees and so on. Not for many needs. These, as you know, and beans are not a good thing for swimming with, but they had in the method and they all that they required, and they partook of this fruit, and these seeds or whatever they partook of, they nourished them up and they were looking there and hunter at the end of the dear brethren, I wonder do we know that our God can not only give us strength, but he can bless the three beginnings. And we all do it, I hope we do it, thankfully, we prepare the table. And we bow our heads, we thank God for the person. We seek to meet the singleness of heart. And we can not only thank him for providing it, but we can also thank him that he can bless it to us when we need it. For we need his blessing with our fruit, as well as blessing him for giving it to us.
Then again, you will notice that these boys were introduced into James. I would listen carefully. Babylon would kind of change their name. Babylon was changing their group, but they weren't taking that. Babylon was changing their thinking. And Babylon was changing their language. And that's a mean thing. Did you know that one of the things was changing their name? They'll put names on people that are alive and dead. You don't know that.
They're calling names that are not in the scriptures. Names perhaps to honor some great leader, or to honor some great doctrine, or some name like that, but they're not in the Bible. Now, all the names that these boys had, in some way or other, connected them with the Lord.
Their parents, when calling them the name, they introduced the idea of God or the Lord into their name.
Now, for the sake of you young Christians, for God, or young in time, don't forget that when you see a name in your Bible ending with E-L, that last two letters, those last two letters indicate that that's God, whatever the first bit of it. The name, for instance, Beth-El, is house. Beth is house. And El is God. So wherever you get El at the end of a name, Ezekiel, Daniel, any of those ELs at the end, that always is God. When you get IRH at the end of a name in the Old Testament, such as Isaiah, or Jeremiah, or Zedekiah, or
like a lion, the IRH, that has always to do with the law, and whatever the first bit will have to be the meaning of the name. So there's no difficulty there.
And it wouldn't have been, you know, in the quota. Young wife's God and God's name.
They'll be reminded of God every time the names were called. Every day the rover was called and the beer rover.
Every time you were called for a name. To have God's name mentioned in the word of the land. What a day.
The principal of the schools, what did he do? He just changed their names and put heathen names in. Instead of the name of God. That is, he brought in the names of the angels. And he linked their names in some way or other. I'm not told you in here, but I'm all for you. Do I have a note of them as well? Ask them what they mean. What he changed the names so as to put heathen ideas every time they were called.
Now, people don't say, Larry, what's the name? See, what's what you call the Christian? The Bible calls them Christians. Calls them believers. Calls them saints. Calls them children of God. Well, those are names that will fit all the Christians. In all the world. But I'm saying, putting good security names on them. You're living.
Is that a
wonder? I wonder, you're taking the name away from them.
The God is doing them. And you're using worldly names to describe people. That God never used.
And the Bible doesn't authorize you to do so. What's the way you think of the Lord's people? Because we have got to remember that God has given names to us. And we should be thankful for them. And not ashamed of them. And we should use them with care when we're speaking and our fellow believers. In that way, we don't cause any division amongst the saints by theirs.
And let me show this other point. 3 years. You know, it's probably like the length of time you spend for getting a degree, isn't it, at the university? 3 year course, and you should have any ticket. Normally, by you get a 4 year course. If you go for to be an architect, you're going to get a first 6 year course and 3 years more. But you get a bit of practice. And if you're a doctor, you get something about the same. But 3 years is the common period for second and degree. So these boys, we might say, they had passed their examination, they had entered the college, and they were given 3 years to do their learning. On the examination, they came. And they went in before they came. They couldn't do it. I don't know how you got put. You have no idea what it was like for a human being. For a young boy, maybe in his 17th, 18th year, to stand before Nebuchadnezzar. You know, the Harry Potter would have made you shudder. You know, they're talking about the nervousness. Why would you go like what you have a name like it for a while? You get nervous, please, now. I think I am the second and equal man in my son.
No one ever just needs to say the word in your head about it. Jimmy would easily, Jimmy would accept it. He didn't worry about a man doing his life. This is the truth this whole day. Never did a heathen eye look as specimens of humanity like this before. He had never seen the leg of him before. He couldn't question their ability. He couldn't question their success. He couldn't doubt it for a moment. But they had been all that he expected them to be. For little did he know that he was standing in the presence of those that were going to educate him in a very short time. Many dear men, we need to be careful. Here's a big man, big in his own estimation, big in his ideas, big in his adventures, big in his successes, big in his triumphs. Begin at research. And before all's over, it's going to be a message. Did you know, dear child of God, that you have a knowledge that the greatest men in the world knew nothing about? Knew nothing about. That you could sit down beside the greatest immortal man. Thank you.
And we can actually meet the bones that are viewed in humanist formation as great men. And yet, when it comes to eternal things, you know nothing. You know nothing whatever. Isn't that what to think of the darkness that's in the world? And to think that we possess the light. I think there are other ways we're interested in it, aren't there? We have to learn, God willing, I should, that God wants to bring about a open door. I hope we appreciate this, because we need a lot of people coming on these things. It's just so many amazing things in the church that everybody reads. I appreciate everybody that comes from that but I don't think exactly that's the way it's in the day. Now I know where to begin to lose the legacy. But I can see in my Bible that God starts machinery moving to bring into life and to bring into opportunity those that will serve him and those that he has a fitted to serve. So that the very movement of the king's life was so ordered by God as we see in the Word of God tomorrow night, so that he will bring with me. And those very dreams, as it were, the dream would be the very instrument of God used to bring his men into God. Now, let me tell that very word to your mind, because I think you maybe haven't grasped what I'm saying. God had one nation of the old economy when they knew his name, that nation of Israel. He had a number of missionaries that he sent out from that nation to other lands that knew his name. He sent Joseph. He sent Joseph down into Egypt. You know that. And Joseph's example must have been a great cheer to these young men. And before he had finished, Joseph had made known in the name of the Lord. You hear that? Now he sent one mission into Egypt to make known his name. Now he's sending these Hebrews, particularly Daniel, into Babylon to make known his name. Missionaries, where are they stopping? What do we say? God lost in the land where he brought his servant to open the door for their testimony to bring them to. I hope we grasp that. That is, God brought the summer into Egypt to bring that to the land. God brought the king into Nebuchadnezzar to bring Daniel into view and to make his name known. And you see, the Persian Empire also needed a missionary, as you see, and Daniel in the dance, then became the missionary to the Persian. God made his name known to heathen change. Don't bring that up there, I would go looking at the village. What's he doing? He brings people into certain countries where you see them. I repeat it a bit over. I wonder, are we aware that many of them have heard the gospel? We hardly know of them. Nobody told that God would make us. I wonder where to see that he's moving to bring people into conditions where there was no